Hey, GeoTrekkers, welcome to a very special episode of the GeoTrek Podcast, episode number 100. I cannot believe we made it to 100 podcasts, and we could not have done it without you, our faithful listeners. Thank you so much for your support, encouragement, and hard work that you've done to share this podcast with your family and friends, as well as extreme weather enthusiasts and those interested in disaster science. I also have to start off this episode by thanking our amazing team at GeoTrek and Blue Leopard Agency, who have worked tirelessly to produce and promote this podcast. Jeremiah Long works hard on every single episode to do so much audio magic, from clipping interviews to mixing music, while Ashley Anderson has been working hard for several years now to promote each episode on social media and helping our team to find great guests. Seneth Baker has provided vision and leadership for this podcast from the very beginning, and Vanny Bolin has been helping us a lot this year to create sharp-looking graphic design. I would also like to thank our parent company, CNC Catastrophe and National Claims, who powers the GeoTrek podcast through financial support and continuous guidance on many levels. As we talked about what to cover for episode number 100, an international theme originally came to mind. I was planning to travel to Venice, Italy for the EVEN 2024 Extreme Weather Statistics Conference in July and a stop in England to meet up with my good friend Ivan Haig, star of GeoTrek podcast number 32, came to mind as we could record interviews about hazards on a global scale at the National Oceanography Center in Southampton, England. But a historic weather event asserted itself into the world of extreme weather before I could take this trip, changing my travel itinerary and our plans for GeoTrek podcast number 100. Historic Hurricane Beryl formed east of the Caribbean in late June and quickly started breaking all kinds of records. It became the farthest east hurricane to form in the month of June, and then after intensifying, it became the first Cat 4 hurricane in June and the earliest Cat 5 hurricane on record in the Atlantic Basin. To top it all off, after making landfall in the Caribbean and Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, Beryl made a landfall as a rare July hurricane in the state of Texas, greatly impacting my hometown of Galveston. I would have had to leave for Europe in the middle of hurricane recovery when I felt like so many people could use my help. So I canceled the international trip, stayed in coastal Texas, and we pivoted episode number 100 to cover this historic storm. The GeoTrek podcast explores the world to tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We focus these stories on the physical processes that generate such extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of such disasters to reduce the loss of life and property. This podcast features interviews with Brian McNulty, Senior Research Associate at the University of Miami, and Phil Klotzbach, Senior Research Scientist at Colorado State University and star of GeoTrek podcast number 72. We've also included some on-the-ground interviews recorded about the storm impacts and lessons learned that can apply to anywhere vulnerable to natural disasters. Well, hey, without further introduction, let's jump into GeoTrek podcast number 100, Historic Hurricane Beryl, with Brian McNulty and Phil Klotzbach. Let's open up with Brian McNulty, who is going to tell us why Hurricane Beryl was so historic. Brian, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Always a joy, Hal. I'm very, very glad to be here.
Brian, I mean, so many people now talking about historic Hurricane Beryl, and you have some interesting context where you're kind of putting this in the big picture. I mean, when you look at this storm, what stands out to you about it?
The thing that stands out is not the hurricane itself or what it did. It's when it happened. It's a hurricane that would have been exceptional even if it happened at the peak of hurricane season. You know, that it reached Category 5 intensity, which very, very few storms do in the Atlantic, you know, somewhere in the 3 to 3.5% range. So it's exceptional no matter what, but to happen when it did is unprecedented.
Right. I mean, seeing something like this in late June, it's like we've never seen anything close to this before, right?
Right. Yeah. It's, it became the first Category 5 in the Atlantic by about a 2-week margin. So that's a pretty big margin to be breaking records by. And it broke the record set in 2005, which is not a year you want to be competing with.
Right. We know that was a very hyperactive season as well. I mean, so what does this make you think as we're moving into this hurricane season? What are some things we're really concerned about as we look out at the basin right now?
Well, I think So we started two of the three named storms we've had so far were fairly forgettable, Alberto and Chris, which is kind of more of what we generally expect to see at this early part of the season. We don't normally expect to see a long track African wave become a Category 5 hurricane at the end of June. So I think it does portend a bit of what we might see of storms that form or intensify or reach peak intensities where and when they normally would not. And Hurricane Beryl was the perfect example of that. Going into the season, there's all these super high expectations of a hyperactive hurricane season. And that doesn't tell you anything about exactly when or, where certain storms will form. So you don't have that level of insight, I guess, but you do have general expectations, and that hurricane fit the expectations perfectly.
Brian, we talk about these easterly African waves coming off of Africa, these strong disturbances and these waves of disturbed weather with low pressure, a lot of thunderstorms firing, moving from east to west across the Atlantic. This is typically something we see more in August and September, but you were explaining even last year, also in June, we were seeing some really uncharacteristic stuff out there, right? Back in 2023.
Yeah, so this was not the first June that we're have our eyebrows raised. 2023, we also had record-breaking warm ocean temperatures in the tropical Atlantic, continuing into 2024. But in 2023, in June, we had two named storms, Brett and Cindy, both form in that part of the tropical Atlantic east of the Caribbean, so between the Caribbean Sea and the coast of Africa. That is not something we normally see in June. And then, so in 2023, the part that was unprecedented is not only did it happen, but they were both active at the same time.
Wow. So to see two active storms out there in late June, like we said, that's normally an August, September thing. So it seems like with these record warm water temps out there, we're seeing the season kind of push up earlier on the calendar, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not necessarily that you get a lot of quote-unquote pre-season storms, storms that are blowing up before June 1st, because that's not a real strong indication of what the rest of the season is going to hold. But it's that you're kind of extending the prime time of hurricane season, which really is these African easterly waves. That's where the large majority of major hurricanes originate. So that's really kind of the meat of the season. And when you're expanding the amount of time that those have to be impactful, that's where an extended hurricane season becomes a problem.
Brian, so many people are talking about the record warm sea surface temperatures out there. Could you give us a context, like spatially, where is this happening? And for how long have the water temperatures been exceptionally warm out there?
Well, we started seeing the tropical Atlantic and the whole North Atlantic become record-breaking warm last spring, March, April, May, depending on what region exactly, but that general ballpark in 2023, and it really hasn't stopped. So during much of 2024, it's been breaking the records that were just set a year ago. In some parts of the Atlantic right now, it's very much in line with what 2023 was, which is still very high. Just because it's not breaking that record sometimes is not much of a prize. It's been for over a year. I mean, in general, again, it depends on exactly where you're looking at, but in general, it's been record-breaking warm for at least a year. And in general, it's been throughout the tropical Atlantic, not so much the Gulf of Mexico. That comes and goes. Being a relatively, compared to the Atlantic, it's a relatively small body of water. It's also not as deep, so it's more prone to more rapid ups and downs. So it has had record warm times, but then it's had some fairly normal times too mixed in. So the Gulf of Mexico, I wouldn't apply that to as much.
Any indication on the physical processes behind the record warmth and how long it might last?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't seen a single convincing argument yet as to what exactly happened in the spring of 2023. There's a few things that I think are involved. We saw basically a breakdown of the subtropical high pressure system over the North Atlantic last spring, which that completely makes sense how that could have triggered the sea surface temperatures in 2023 to be able to spike, because you're reducing the evaporative cooling across the Atlantic because the winds blowing across it are much lower. We also did not really see any of the Saharan dust plumes blowing across the Atlantic last year, also because of that much degraded subtropical high pressure system. So those things definitely helped 2023. That high pressure system that lives in the subtropics is still a little weaker than average, but it's there this year at least. but we're still not relaxing the record warm ocean temperature. So there's more going on than just that. Something else that gets thrown around, which I can't totally negate, is 4 years ago was kind of a change in what ships are allowed to emit. So they were required to emit fewer, I forget what kind of aerosols, but a type of aerosol, which is great because we don't want to be spewing all that junk into the atmosphere. But it turns out that junk that's being spewed in the atmosphere, clouds love to form on that. So you get these nice, bright, reflective clouds that form there along the North Atlantic, where a lot of the ship traffic is. And that's been greatly reduced. So fantastic that we have a lot less junk being spewed in the atmosphere by the ships. But it has perhaps the added effect of heating the oceans, too. Again, I don't know exactly what percentage of the effect to assign to that, but it's probably an effect.
Brian, it's always amazing how things are so interconnected and all these feedback loops and what you're talking about there with more aerosols in the atmosphere, with more cloud cover, even what you mentioned with Saharan dust, all these things can scatter sunlight. And it's just interesting how these feedback loops, you know, some of these questions like, why is the Atlantic warm? It's easy to ask the one sentence question. This could be one or multiple doctoral dissertations, right? Just looking at this. I mean, it's hard, I know, on the spot to give an answer, but you helped our audience get an idea of several bullet points there that maybe contributing factors. Brian, I know you're there in the Miami, South Florida area. Just as we close out the interview here, do you feel like people are taking this hurricane season more seriously than others? Or I know you're in the crosshairs every year, but do you feel a difference just publicly there on the ground this year?
I don't think so. And I think what you said is pretty spot on, that we're in the crosshairs every year. And I think that's the kind of the smarter way to look at it, too, is to not put too much emphasis on the long range outlook for the whole season, but to just take each threat as it comes. If it ends up being zero or one or five, you treat them the same.
Well, that's exactly it. And like the adage goes, you only need one. It only takes one, right? Even if it's a slow season out there, if your community gets hit, it was a big season for you. Brian, I'm hoping for a successful and hopefully quiet tropical season where you're at. We're always following you on social media. You provide such great content for not only academics and people in government, but just, I know a lot of my friends and colleagues are always looking at your stuff as well. So keep up the great work there. We'll continue following you throughout this hurricane season.
All right. Well, I certainly appreciate it, Hal. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Brian, for sharing those perspectives. What really stands out to me in our interview is when you said the most unusual aspect of Beryl was it forming when and where we would not expect such an intense hurricane. We've never seen such a powerful hurricane form so early in the season east of the Caribbean Sea. We continue the conversation about historic Hurricane Beryl with Phil Klotzbach from Colorado State University. Phil, everyone's been talking about historic Hurricane Beryl. From a hurricane climatology perspective, what made this storm so historic?
Yeah, it's mainly because of when it did what it did. So, you know, we get Category 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic, but we don't normally get them in early July. It was the earliest Category 5 hurricane on record. It reached Category 5 strength early on the 2nd of July. The prior record was the 17th of July, set by Hurricane Emily in 2005. So, you know, breaking records by 2 weeks. The Atlantic hurricane season is extremely peaked. So while the season starts June 1st, we normally don't get our strong hurricanes till we get to August and September. So, you know, 2 weeks doesn't necessarily seem like that big of a deal, but in the Atlantic it is, because our climatology is so peaked. So that was really what was most notable about it. I mean, we had 165 mile an hour winds when it was at its strongest, which is the strongest for any hurricane in the Atlantic on record prior to the 1st of August. I mean, but it did this, you know, in early July. So we're setting these records that, you know, pre-August records in the first week of July, which is, again, quite impressive.
Wow, that's so interesting, Phil. So I think you had told me before that, statistically speaking, only around 3% of major hurricanes in the Atlantic happen in June and July. So to get a Cat 5 hurricane so early in the season is really remarkable, right?
It is, yeah. And I think really one of the big things with Beryl is, you know, normally if we were to talk about, you know, what about early season activity? Does it correlate with the rest of the season? The answer is normally not really. But historically, if you look at storm activity that forms, especially east of the Lesser Antilles, like where Beryl did, and then and gets strong in the as approaching the islands and then in the Eastern Caribbean, that's typically a harbinger of an extremely active Atlantic hurricane season. The records that Beryl was setting were set by storms that occurred in, say, 1933, which was the record holder for the most named storms prior to 2005, and had generated the most accumulated cyclone energy, which is basically the, if you're a baseball fan, it's the OPS of hurricanes. It's an integrated metric accounting for storm frequency, intensity, and duration. 1933 was the most for an individual season on record. So setting these records that were set in extremely busy seasons, typically early season storms, you don't get a lot in the main development region, Eastern Caribbean, because shear's too strong, the air is too dry, and the waters typically are just kind of cold, especially east of the islands. But this year, we've talked many times about how hot the Atlantic is, so that really wasn't an inhibiting factor. And also, because that Atlantic was so hot, basically generated atmospheric conditions such that it reduced the shear. The shear was generally very low, because normally in late June, early July, the shear is quite strong. So you have to really, really tamp down the shear compared with normal to get a storm, and especially a storm like Beryl, because to get a Category 5 hurricane, you need to have a very low shear environment. And if you look at Beryl at its time of peak intensity, it was almost perfectly symmetrical, which is evidence of that extremely low shear at the time that it reached its strongest intensity.
Thank you, Phil. That's really very interesting insight. So would you say that Hurricane Beryl may be a bad omen of the emerging Atlantic hurricane season?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, again, normally early season storm activity doesn't, but I think Beryl is kind of a warning sign of what we may expect to see as we get later into the season, because those extremely hot Atlantic water temperatures are still there. So that's going to be there throughout. And so overall, the conditions should be more conducive for storm activity. Now, since Beryl, it's gotten a lot quieter, which is good. Obviously, no one's complaining, but that's normal for mid to late July. Overall, the atmospheric circulation patterns, we have kind of the hot Atlantic and the likely trend towards La Nina that are going to likely drive things on a seasonal timescale. But you can also get what we call subseasonal, so shorter than seasonal variability, things such as the Batten-Julian oscillation, and they can kind of come out. These circulations run on shorter timescales. It could either increase or decrease the shear relative to kind of what the larger scale conditions would dictate. So right now the shear is running, even though the MJO or the Madden-Julian oscillation is right now pretty non-conducive, the shear is running about average, which to me also highlights if you have basically unfavorable subseasonal conditions and that makes it the shear near average, when we get the favorable subseasonal conditions, the shear is likely to be extremely low, which is so right now we're looking at potentially something maybe starting to get ramped up here in about probably the first week of August. Then that likely the end of July is going to end up being pretty quiet. The shear is fairly high. There's still a fair amount of dust out there. But probably by the time we get to early August, things will be coming more conducive. And climatologically, or on average, that's about when that starts to occur. You get, I believe, 96% of your major hurricanes occur after the 1st of August. So while the season's 6 months long, really the stuff doesn't typically ramp up until we get to August.
Phil, we've talked before about your team at Colorado State ringing a bell when the peak of the Atlantic hurricane season arrives. Could you tell us a little bit about that tradition and on what date you ring the bell?
Yeah, so we ring the bell every year on August the 20th. So my mentor, Dr. Bill Gray, who founded the Atlantic Seasonal Forecast, used to do it every year on August 20th, signaling the active part of the season. If you look at, you know, NOAA's hurricane climatology website, there's a big spike around August 20th. And I think that's about the time where your shears are low, but that's about the time the waters start to get really warm. There's enough moisture, the dust off of Africa tends to subside. So on average, that's about when things really ramp up. And last year's a great example. We went a while. We went several weeks with nothing in the Atlantic after Hurricane Dawn in early July. And there was a lot of discussion mid-August. Oh, you know, maybe the season's going to be quiet. The bell rang August 20th, and we had 13 storms form in 39 days. So things got ramped up in a hurry. So last year's a great example of why, you know, why we do ring that bell every year, is because that really is when the season really ramps up. Now, I think this year, obviously, the bell kind of already rang with Beryl, and we'll likely get an additional bell ringing, I think, a couple weeks before August 20th. But that's typically when the season in the Atlantic really ramps up, is around August 20th.
Phil, when it comes to Atlantic hurricanes, we talk about these special dates on the calendar, like June 1st and August 20th. You've helped explain to us that it's really all about the changing physics around certain times of the year. Could you please explain a little bit more about that?
Correct. Yeah. And that's the thing that's interesting, is you can kind of plot for August 20th, you can kind of plot like your sea surface temperatures, your shear, your moisture. And that's kind of like when they intersect. So the shear can tend to be fairly low even earlier in August, but there's still, you still get a fair amount of dry air off Africa. There's a lot, there can still be a decent amount of dust. And the sea surface temperatures really start to, or continue to ramp up through August into September. So August 20th is kind of about that time where, if you were to plot, you know, shear, sea surface temperatures, and say mid-level moisture, it's about when they all kind of get to a point where they're all pretty conducive. And then on the other hand, by the time you get to early October, the water temperatures are actually still warming a little bit. And the moisture is still fairly decent, but the shear starts to get fairly strong, which is why typically by the time we get to October, you don't really see stuff forming off of Africa. By then, you see stuff shifting more further towards the west, more towards the Caribbean, where the water is obviously extremely warm. The shear still tends to be fairly low. And in October, you tend to have kind of a broad area of low-level spin. We call like a Central American or Caribbean gyre, which helps to spin up your late season storm. So there's physical reasons why the climatology is there.
Thanks so much for taking time to explain these physical processes, Phil, and for helping us to see how these factors are so interconnected. So many people turn to your team at CSU for seasonal hurricane forecasts. I was wondering if you could give us an update on the latest forecast.
Yeah, so our last update was on July the 9th. At that point, we forecast 25 named storms. That does include the three we've already had. Of those 25, 12 becoming hurricanes, so 11 more because we obviously had Beryl. Six major hurricanes, five more since we had Beryl. And so that's a slight increase from what we forecast in April and June, primarily due to both Beryl generating already a lot of numbers, more than we normally would anticipate that early, but also just overall the large-scale conditions look to be quite conducive. We'll put out a final update on August the 6th, and starting August the 6th and issued every 2 weeks after that, we also put out sub-seasonal forecasts where we'll try to pinpoint above or below normal periods. And with the sub-seasonal forecast, one of the things I think that's interesting about those is with the seasonal forecast, we can say, hey, the season looks busy. But once you get the sub-seasonal forecast, we can start to kind of highlight areas where we may see storms form, which I think obviously becomes a lot more relevant for, say, impacts. Because, for example, last year we put out a forecast, I think, on August 19th, and we said, yeah, the main development region looks busy. Most of those storms are probably going to go out to sea. But maybe something in the Eastern Gulf, Western Caribbean, late August, that's probably the thing we want to be most concerned about, and that turned out to be Hurricane Idalia. So by then, you can start to look at the models and get some better insights as to exactly where storms may go. So stay tuned for that. Again, we'll put out our first update, our first sub-seasonal forecast, with our final seasonal forecast on August the 6th.
Thanks so much, Phil, for taking time to come on the podcast. The biggest take-home point I had from our interview was that you said just having a big storm early in the hurricane season does not necessarily point to an active season, but the fact that Beryl formed into such an intense hurricane in the main development region east of the Caribbean does confirm that conditions should be more favorable than normal in that region to develop a lot of activity once we get into the more active part of the season in August and September. After impacting the Caribbean and Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, Beryl made landfall as a Category 1 hurricane along the Texas coast. It made landfall near Matagorda, Texas, with sustained winds of around 80 miles an hour. What really made the news, though, were the massive power outages in the Houston-Galveston corridor that left 2.7 million customers in the dark. As this heavily populated corridor observed sustained tropical storm force winds with some hurricane force gusts, millions of people were thrown into a difficult situation from a rare July hurricane landfall in Texas. Beryl was only the 10th July hurricane to make landfall in Texas since 1851. The timing of this hurricane introduced more impacts than normal for a Texas hurricane. Most hurricanes have impacted the state in August or September when the weather is hot, but not as oppressively hot as it is in early July in many regions. Unfortunately, the heat turned into a public health crisis as many heat-related illnesses and some fatalities were reported in the days after Hurricane Beryl blew through. Another impact was the massive economic hit to tourism, as July is the busiest month of the year along the Texas coast. These crowds die down in August and September when hurricanes normally impact the state. To make matters even worse, Beryl was forecast to hit everywhere from South Padre Island all the way up the coast to Galveston, placing much of the state in the cone of uncertainty at some point, with a landfall forecast near the end of the usually busy 4th of July holiday weekend. Needless to say, a lot of people canceled their plans to come to the coast. These are additional impacts not seen from later hurricanes and tie what Brian and Phil said about the unusual timing of Beryl into stories about how this impacted people on the ground. Nonetheless, Texans came together in the days after Hurricane Beryl, with neighbors helping neighbors and many people coming out to share their stories and lessons learned. I recorded several interviews in the Galveston Walmart parking lot where a man named Nicholas Barrios came up with the idea to stage an area where he could cook thawing meat to feed hungry people. His new friend Michael joined him in this endeavor, and dozens of people stepped up to volunteer and donate food. This became Operation Feed the Need. I interviewed Michael in the parking lot to get a little more of the backstory. Michael, just appreciate the hard work you're doing here. How did this spring up here?
Well, I'll be honest with you, it was just a last minute thing. My neighbor who lives in the same RV park who flooded with me said he was going to be doing some volunteer work and grilling for people. So I said, absolutely, let's do it. You know.
Well, I've seen people that say, hey, my meat is going to spoil if I leave it at home. They're bringing it and donating, right? And you have stores donating as well?
Absolutely. We have stores donating. Matter of fact, we just got a bunch of water donation from Lowe's, like 32 pallets of I don't know how much water. And what we're going to do with it, but we're going to try to give it back to the community. So well,
this is amazing just how quickly it sprung up. I mean, just we're not that far after the storm and y'all are already here serving the community.
Well, you know, I can honestly say I've always wanted to do, and I'm getting the opportunity, so I'm going to let it shine. That's what we're going to do.
What Nick, Michael, and their army of volunteers were doing ties into the concept of pay it forward, when help is freely given without an obligation to pay it back. The giver just wants the recipient to pay it forward to someone else. In the Walmart parking lot, several other pay it forward stories were told. My girlfriend Alicia had a great one, followed up by a woman named Teresa. We're talking about pay it forward stories.
I said, you don't refill these? And he said, no. I said, can you exchange them? Because they had 20-pound canisters stacked behind their fence. And he said, no, that's not what we do here. We distribute. And I was like, oh, come on. And he said, okay. He said, how many do you have? I said, I have 4. And he said, open your car and let's do this quickly. And I said, okay. So I started to go over to my car and I stopped and I said, oh, your electricity's out, but I do have cash to pay for this. And he said, no, I can't even charge you. We don't sell propane. He said, I'm just exchanging tanks for you, so let's get this done.
And he was looking for a reason. He said, do you have like elderly or disabled people? She's like, no, but I'm a single mom of 4. And he was like, okay, let's make this happen.
Kids, we need AC. So anyway, when he said, I'm just exchanging these for you, I was like, come here. And he was like, no, I'm not going to hug you. I'm super dirty. I said, I don't care. I'm super dirty. I'm hugging you. And so I gave him a big hug and we exchanged the tanks really quickly. And he said, all I want you to do is pay it forward at some point. And I said, not a problem. But as we were loading the tanks into the van, he was like, God bless you. Jesus loves you. And we were like, that's right. Amen. And he was like, wait, I knew you were a believer. And so then he began to share how exhausted they are because they're distributing this propane
all day long, just trying to serve people.
He said, we've been going nonstop since before the hurricane hit. We're exhausted. He said, please, my name is, please pray for us. Like, we need help. And yeah. So we like stood right in the parking lot and like prayed with him right there, you know, but it was just such a neat like experience because it's this full circle moment. Like we're out there doing things, trying to help keep people informed. You see different people on all these community pages. Yeah. I need a fan. I need this. I need some water. Or I need these things. And other people are stepping up and giving it. And so it's just neat to see that. It's like we can give. Sometimes we're giving. And then other times you're receiving. And it's just...
What was your name again?
I'm Teresa.
And what was your pay it forward story?
So my husband was stuck in Conroe. And he was stuck on... He's on his way to Minnesota to go get me a generator, by the way.
Wait, so he's driving from Texas to Minnesota and back to bring you a generator. That's amazing.
And and he's got my dog with him, and my dog gets very frustrated when he's warm. But also, so he was stuck in Conroe. He got stuck at a gas station. We were trying to figure out how to get him gas. All of a sudden, someone told us that there was gas down by Walmart, and he's like, but I can't get there because I'm on fumes. So apparently this guy saw him at the gas station. He said, man, he goes, I've seen you for a while. What's going on here? And he goes, I'm stuck on fumes. There's nowhere to go. He says, I'm trying to get to Minnesota. And he goes, all right. He says, well, let me give you about a gallon or 2 gallons to at least get you to where you need to go. So hopefully.
Oh, you just freely gave him the gas.
Yeah. My husband offered to give him money, and the guy said no. He said, don't even bother with that. He goes, this is Texas. He says, we take care of each other. He's like, just pay it forward at some time. So.
Wow, it's so encouraging to hear these positive pay it forward stories. There were so many more playing out in our neighborhoods. At one point, several people helped us out, and then we were able to give away a box fan to someone who needed it and provide a wash basin for a woman who came to our door who needed to wash clothes by hand. What came to mind through all of this is the advice that Alan Seals gave on GeoTrek podcast number 96, that one of the most important things you can do before enduring a hurricane is to build community so that you can help others and they can help you as well. There in the Walmart parking lot, we also heard stories of ways that Beryl blindsided people. I made friends with a man named Paul who shared how his car got stuck in his garage. Paul, you mentioned about some of the impacts that you're facing where you live. I mean, what are some of the things you're facing right now?
Well, the main thing that I should remind people is that when they have a garage, to make sure that their emergency release rope on the inside is connected, so that when you put your car in the garage and you close your garage and you forget to unlatch that so that you can do it manually, make sure that you do unlatch it so that you don't get stuck with your car in the garage and in an emergency you can't get anywhere.
So your situation, in a sense, until the power comes back, you can't get that garage door up.
That is correct. And I've called around several places, electricians, garage door openers, and they all say you're just going to have to wait.
So there's no, like, emergency release or something you can do manually. And in that sense, you have to wait for the power.
Previous owner took it off. I had bought one on Amazon. I have it sitting on my table in the house. Then the storm came, and I was just preoccupied with the hurricane, never thought about it, never thought to go outside and make sure that it was released so that I could open it manually. Power goes out, I'm stuck.
Well, it's these things when these storms are coming, you have so many things on your checklist, right? And that's something that could easily escape your notice, right?
That's correct. And I would suggest that everybody goes and buys a little gas stove grill. They're about $80, but it's well worth it because that way you can get little propane tanks. You can feed yourself at home and not worry about it. You might be hot, but at least you'll have food.
Paul, the storm itself, is it pretty much what you expected? Was it worse than you expected? I mean, how did this play out from in your perspective?
To me, I mean, the storm to me wasn't that bad. The damage was bad compared to previous storms. But the actual storm, it blew through pretty quickly. But the damage that it left behind was something that everybody has to cope with.
I think a lot of us were surprised by the collapse of the energy infrastructure. And here in Galveston, still the majority of the people are without power.
Definitely surprised. When about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, when we had the ice storm, we didn't lose any power at all. There was even snow on the beach, but we never lost power. This time around, with the amount of over 2 million people out of electricity and no power, I mean, it's panic stages for a lot of people.
Well, and hitting in July, a lot of times if we're getting hurricanes, it's more late August, early September, when it's still hot, but the sun's a little bit lower in the sky. This is like the hottest time of the year, so a lot of people are going home to very hot houses, right?
Right, correct. So prepare, because the season is just starting. We've still got another 5-6 months of this, so prepare. Make sure that you've got everything ready for these hurricanes, because they blow up quickly.
Paul, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I do hope as quick as possible of a recovery for you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
After speaking with Paul, I interviewed a man named Ben who shared about the unbearable heat in the days after Hurricane Beryl and how he unsuccessfully tried to get a generator but could not get one in time. His generator arrived after the power outage, but at least he will be more prepared for the next storm. Well, I'm here at the community, this kind of relief thing that stepped up. Ben, you've been impacted by the storm. I mean, what was it like for you going through that?
Oh, it's been hell. It's been hell. I went through Harvey and I went through all these, but with all this power for days and days and, you know, not being able to, you know, eat food in your house and the hot weather, it's hard. It's hard.
Well, it's been so hot inside so many of our houses. I mean, you've probably noticed that in your house too, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I have to go into the, shower with cold water and basically, you know, soak myself down, get in the bed. I've even tried the, getting a blanket and just soaking it wet and covering it up with myself, but eventually it gets warm, so I got to redo it and put it, So, yeah, I'm trying to find any method to keep warm.
Does it help to go leave the house and go outside? It's actually
sometimes
cooler outside.
Sometimes, yeah, it does. It does help. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Any tips for people that are maybe going through their first hurricane? I mean, you've been through a few of them.
Yeah. Tell you the truth, just be prepared. I mean, I messed up. I didn't have a generator, but be prepared. Be prepared and take care of everything. I got enough water. I got about 8 gallons or 5 gallon jugs of water in my house, but I didn't prepare with the generator.
It sounds like you ordered one, but it's going to take a little time to come.
Yeah,
it's
actually my brother. I ordered one from Puerto Rico, and it's coming through Amazon, but it's going to take until Tuesday. But at least I'll have it for the next one.
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything you can to get through and cooling yourself the best you can.
Yes.
Ben, I hope for a quick recovery.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Wow, so many stories coming out of the Walmart parking lot there in Galveston, Texas, where I live. Most of these interviews really speak for themselves, and I don't have a lot to add, but one main point I will make is to urge you, the listener, if you live in a disaster-prone community, prepare for extended power outages or other life disruptions before a disaster hits your community. One lesson I learned in Beryl is the value of having a dual-fuel or tri-fuel generator that can run on different power sources. A tri-fuel generator will run on gasoline, propane, or natural gas. If you have a natural gas line in your home or business, this can make things much easier for you. If you can run a generator off your natural gas, you can avoid waiting in long gas lines or dealing with propane shortages. So many people I talked to in the days after Beryl said the storm caught them unprepared, and they assured me that that will not happen again. We're expecting August and September to be very busy months for hurricane activity in the Atlantic Basin. Although we can't stop the storms from coming, we hope that the insights you gain from this podcast will help you be better prepared for any extreme weather or natural disasters you might face. Until we meet again, stay safe and also try to get outdoors during the beautiful Northern Hemisphere summer. This is Hurricane Hal, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek Podcast.